Good evening and welcome back to Sports Talk ATL. I am Chase Earl, joined by Alex Ord. Great show for you today. We are going to get deeper into the Super Bowl and who is going to win that contest between the Chiefs and the 49ers. We are going to talk about Michael Penix, Bo Nix, J.J. McCarthy, and their draft status. But we're going to talk about some things that were said on Foul Territory, a show that I have suggested a lot on here. And some comments from Jeff Francoeur about Orlando Arcia, the Braves postseason run, and that sort of thing, because it's some things that we have hinted to all offseason that need to be fixed if the Braves want to come back in 2024 and win the World Series, which is the ultimate goal. This is a World Series or bust team.
Yeah, and I think that most of the offseason was addressed. Alex Anthopoulos, you know, obviously one of the best GMs in sports, knows that this team, as currently constructed, before the Kelenic acquisition, before the Chris Sale acquisition, this team wins 90-plus games and runs away with the NL East. What could he do differently that's going to translate in October? And it's exactly what Francoeur addressed. It's basically the attitude of the team. What is the difference between that 2021 World Series team and the past two teams that have been knocked out by the Phillies? It's that attitude. It's that grit. It's that stuff that Jock Peterson had. And specifically, Francoeur mentioned Freddie Freeman in that kind of leadership aspect of the team.
Yeah, I mean, don't even get me started on Freddie Freeman, because as I've said, that's the worst decision in franchise history. Now, of course, Matt Olson made me eat my words a little bit, but I do think there is an aspect of the team that a lot of people don't talk about, and it is that leadership role. And if you listen to AJ Minter on Foul Territory, same show, you should totally go check it out. He said the Braves are missing a little bit of that FU attitude. Same thing Austin Riley said, same thing Spencer Strider hinted at. So you can lose a series in October to the Philadelphia Phillies, who are 10 plus games worse than you one time, and you can say, hey, it was an anomaly. You do it twice in exactly the same fashion, you can no longer say that that's just a random act, even in the game of baseball, when randomness kind of, you know, rules the entire game. So there's something that the Braves need to fix in 2024. I think they have addressed that internally, and I think that's why you're hearing players say it. Like, we need more leadership. Jeff Francoeur mentioned Austin Riley specifically as a guy who can take over that Freddie Freeman-esque role. But I think that's a natural thing. And maybe Riley grows into that. But I think more than anything, it needs to be a team effort. I look at a guy like Spencer Strider. He has a fiery personality. He has never shied away from the Braves' opening goal of winning a World Series. That is the goal. Anything else is utter disappointment, just like we fans think. I think it has to be a collective group effort. We talked about Chris Sale. Obviously, he can bring some of that stuff, but he's a new face in the locker room. It takes a lot. It takes a brash personality, like we saw with Jock Peterson, to come in and immediately grab guys' attention and have you gravitate you. Maybe that is someone like, maybe that's who Chris Sale is. It is who he has been in his career, but I think it's going to be a team effort rather than just one person really just owning the kind of talent on this team and what the expectation is.
Yeah, they have to exude confidence, you know, and I think that, you know, what's really important to kind of understand about this whole thing is, though, yes, you know, several guys are going to have to step up. There's no doubt about that. You lose in the same way two postseasons in a row. Something has to change. But the fact is people can grow into these roles. You know, the core of this team is so young that maybe they don't even know themselves, let alone, you know, what they can be. And you said Spencer Strider. That's a guy to me that sticks out. You know, Spencer Strider is that kind of guy. He's that no BS guy. He's been with the team one full season, and he is already saying the standard is a World Series. He wasn't a part of that 2021 World Series team. So the fact is he already understands that, as Chase said, you know, Francoeur pointed out Austin Riley. But I think, you know, it's not crazy to say that somebody like Ozzie Albies or somebody that you're not really expecting grows into the role. Growing into a leadership role, learning how to be a leader, you're not born a leader. People, you have to go through trials and tribulations, and maybe you have some of those attributes that a lot of leaders do, but to become a great leader, you have to learn from great leaders. And those guys that were surrounded by Freddie Freeman and such, you know, obviously took a thing or two away, including Dansby Swanson as well. So, but Francoeur's second point that I think is much more important is the confidence. He pointed to the Orlando Arcia Bryce Harper feud, that, you know, the attaboy Harper, and Harper went on to, we know who Bryce Harper is and what he's capable of. And he took that little ounce of, and it wasn't disrespect. I guarantee you Bryce Harper doesn't think that, but he used that as motivation. That's what great players do. Tom Brady, you know, does it more better than anybody. And he, you know, used that as motivation. Whereas, like, on the flip side of it, it felt like the Braves were, I don't know, tucking tail and kind of like not owning the fact that it was like, yeah, we are those dudes. It was like, you were the best team in the regular season, and now you're tucking tail in your first series. It was very discouraging. And as you mentioned, it felt like game four was already lost before it was played by those comments.
Yeah, I think this thing gets me fired up more than anything, because the way that the Braves reacted to that entire situation was utterly embarrassing. They should be embarrassed, because you're talking about, first of all, this is a division rival. First of all, this is Philadelphia. Those guys went in there and got trashed by their fans, were mocked. They lost to them the year before. This is a playoff series. So even if there wasn't a rivalry involved, but this is a rivalry with a team that just knocked you out when you had World Series aspirations the year before. And you sit there and you're walking your comments back, comments that were made in silent, comments that maybe should have never leaked, but you're more worried about these things being leaked from the locker room and the sanctity of the locker room than winning game four. I was waiting for any player to step up and say, hey, we are, as Jock would say, those mother effers, we are those dudes. Who cares what Orlando Arcia said? Yes, he said it. We are going to beat this team. I don't care. They were almost scared to get beat up by the Philadelphia Phillies. I mean, if this were a street fight, they were begging for mercy from Bryce Harper. Please do not hurt us. And obviously, we know what happened in game four. He goes out there and blasts a couple of home runs, wins the series. But Bryce Harper didn't need that motivation. He was going to do that regardless. They looked like scared puppies in that situation. It was one of the things that really pissed me off. That situation was more embarrassing than losing to the Phillies itself. The fact that they were even answering questions seriously about what came out off, instead of one, ignoring it, that would have been a better option, or two, saying, screw it.
Yeah, there was two options they really could have gone with. You know, we're not focused on that. We're focused at the task at hand, obviously the playoff series with the Phillies. Or they could have, like you said, just own it. Just be like, yeah, we are those dudes, and we're going to come back and win this series. It's very simple. They chose the latter. They chose to kind of scrutinize the media and say, you know, there's no place for that in baseball.
Yeah, it was extremely discouraging. And as I said when I wrote about this, that, you know, you could almost feel that the team, like, they had been gut punched, and they had Spencer Strider on the mound, their best pitcher, arguably the best pitcher in baseball, on the mound, ready to set them up for success and take this game four in Philadelphia and move it to a game five. They almost acted like the series was over. I mean, it's one of those things where I really have never felt more embarrassed for a club that was as good as they were, because they were too damn good to be making decisions like that. Coming up after the break, JJ McCarthy, could he be a top 10 draft pick? Some people think so. Every offseason, there is a group of players, specifically at the quarterback position, that go much higher than people expect. And then every offseason, it's the other side, go much lower. Benjamin Albright, we've talked about these three quarterbacks, that second tier of quarterbacks, Bo Nix, Michael Penix, and JJ McCarthy. Will one of them be in play for the Atlanta Falcons with the 8th overall pick? Albright seems to report, and he's reporting, that the league is much higher on JJ McCarthy, considering him a potential number or top 10 overall pick. Meanwhile, Penix and Nix could be second round or third round or possibly even day three draft picks.
Yeah, this isn't anything surprising, because fans, you know, what we do, and we're fans as well, we just watch this stuff a little bit more intensely than the average fan does, is we can't compartmentalize an entire body of work, whereas most fans, all they saw from a guy like, let's say, Michael Penix or Bo Nix was those couple games a year, was the Pac-12 championship where Michael Penix looked unbelievable. The semifinal game against Texas, Washington versus Texas, Michael Penix looked incredible. And then you go and look at JJ McCarthy's numbers. His numbers are terrible. He didn't throw a single pass in the second half against Penn State. And as a fan, you're going, why would they do that? Well, they don't trust him. That's not necessarily the case. The game dictates what the play calls would be. And Sherrone Moore, obviously, offensive coordinator for Michigan, Penn State couldn't stop Michigan's running game. So what did he do? He just kept running the ball. And, you know, it is funny to me, because Chase and I have been quite outspoken on Twitter, on social media, about how Michael Penix is not in play for the Falcons at the 8th overall pick. And on the flip side, JJ McCarthy certainly is. When an NFL scout, an NFL personnel guy, a GM looks at a prospect, they're looking at projectability. They're not necessarily looking at, you know, one game in particular. They're looking at the projectability of the prospect. And when you look at a guy like J.J. McCarthy, who's 21 years old compared to Michael Penix and Bo Nix, who are 23 and 24, I believe, you kind of look at a guy and go, well, if he had two more years in college, if he had an offense that was an air raid style offense instead of that run heavy offense, what could he potentially do? And that's what these guys are doing. And that's what Albright is reporting, that basically, and as you have said, and as I have said, it's basically, you know, Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, and now it's very clear that it's J.J. McCarthy in that fourth spot, and then Michael Penix and Bo Nix are a little bit below them.
Yeah, I'm a big J.J. McCarthy guy. I never understood the hype on Penix or Nix. I mean, I saw Bo Nix. I mean, we saw Bo Nix at the University of Auburn struggle in a similar type of system. Actually, not really necessarily similar. It was definitely better for a quarterback, but not that, you know, we're playing Pac-12 defense. Let's spread it out. Check it down. I mean, you go watch a Bo Nix game. Sure, he has gaudy stats. How many of those passes were past 5 yards of the line of scrimmage? Now you go look at a Michael Penix game. Yes, he has a fantastic deep ball, and a lot of his passes also were behind or at the line of scrimmage. That intermediate passing game at Washington was not non-existent. That's the most important aspect of a quarterback at the next level. You're not going to just be beating guys wide open deep, and you're not going to just be checking down. I mean, unless you're Brock Purdy, my guy. No, I'm just kidding. But I seriously believe in J.J. McCarthy. I mean, you're talking about a guy who won a national championship at 20 years old. He showed a lot of chops against Alabama. You saw what he could do against an NFL-type defense in that game. He had one of the best drives of the entire season, leading the Michigan Wolverines down to score with 2 minutes left. And I think you see a guy that's 21 years old. He's accurate. He's on time. He's smart. He's a gamer. He's athletic. And I see that that's a ball of clay. Yeah. That's necessarily Bo Nix and Michael Penix are a lot more who they are than J.J. McCarthy is today.
Well, maybe even more importantly than all those things you just listed is the Falcons' current situation. The current situation is going to dictate what quarterback they target. And that current situation is Zach Robinson's offense. Now, he hails from the Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay offensive scheme. And what does that usually dictate at the quarterback position? It's a Matthew Stafford. It's a Matt Ryan. It's a Brock Purdy. Jared Goff. Kirk Cousins. It's guys who can play on time with anticipation and, most importantly, accuracy. So when we're talking about the quarterback situation for the Falcons and who they could potentially target, J.J. McCarthy lines up with a lot of those things.
Yeah, I mean, J.J., it's exactly who he is. And I know Jim Harbaugh joked around about him being the number one overall pick, even though I do not think Jim Harbaugh was joking. But I think there are a lot of things that, you know, people are going to fall in love with J.J. McCarthy and who he is. I think playing with Jim Harbaugh is a fantastic attribute to have when you're going to the next level. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised at not only by how much that people love J.J. McCarthy, but how much more NFL ready he is than a lot of people believe because of the offense that he played in Michigan and because what he was asked to do, expected to do in big moments when really the entire game there wasn't a lot of warmups. Any big moments that he had, he wasn't throwing the ball over the yard. These were plays that he was asked to make when they needed him, and he made them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a big part of all of this is people are going to say that you overdrafted a quarterback or any player if they don't like it. The fact is NFL teams overdraft quarterbacks all the time until they pan out. A couple years ago, several years ago, people said the Chiefs overdrafted on Patrick Mahomes. Now look where we are. It's an overdraft until it works out for your team.
Yeah, and one thing that the Falcons have not done over the last 3 years that we've been, you know, kind of pissing on them for is not taking shots at this quarterback situation. Now we're in the same situation we were 3 years ago with no quarterback and quarterback purgatory. It's the worst place to be in the league. It's almost worse because we keep winning seven games without a quarterback and we can't get one of the top draft picks. So congratulations, you're able to squeeze out seven games and the season's a little more entertaining. But the facts are we're now out of the running for potentially Jaden Daniels, Drake May, and Caleb Williams. And we are in the running choosing between Michael Penix, Bo Nix, and J.J. McCarthy.
That's not really an excuse anymore, though. Like, this roster for Raheem Morris is ready to compete right now. So whether they go J.J. McCarthy, whether they go to veteran route and free agency, it doesn't matter what they do at the quarterback position. The Falcons fans and Arthur Blank alike are expecting this team to win, at least improve upon where they were last year. And, you know, this is very simple. It's more than seven games. Hopefully the NFC South and therefore the postseason.
Well, to me, it's NFC South or bust. And, yeah. and I know I wrote about this, and I know a lot of people don't want to hear about the potential of firing Raheem Morris, but even Big Low Country, who we're all supportive of the Raheem Morris hire. Even he said yesterday, you know, if you don't get it done by 2025, there's not going to be a third year. Like this is not the same situation. There are no just lost years here, especially in a weak NFC South when you just became so close with Desmond Ridder as your starting quarterback. There's no lost years. Like they have to win now. Raheem Morris, and he didn't shy away from those expectations. They have to win right now, or he is going to be fired much quicker than Arthur Smith was, and he only made it 3 years.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, expectations should be tempered depending on what happens at the quarterback position. If we go in with J.J. McCarthy, a rookie, they're going to be at different expectations compared to an established guy like Kirk Cousins. That has to be said.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Coming up after the break, the Chiefs and the 49ers are going to meet in the Super Bowl. We are going to give you an even deeper preview and prediction. The Super Bowl is just a few days away, and it is a rematch of a few years ago. But as we've talked about earlier this week, the matchup is a little bit different this time around. Last time you had a defensive team in the San Francisco 49ers led by a quarterback in Jimmy G, that they didn't really want to push the ball downfield. They really wanted to shove it down your throats. And that hasn't changed, but they wanted to play good defense and keep you off the board. Now it seems like that's the Chiefs. And I know they have Patrick Mahomes, and I know they have Andy Reid, but they are running the ball more than ever. They have completely adjusted since that Christmas Day disaster against the Las Vegas Raiders, where they had two turnovers that went for touchdowns and ended up losing. The Raiders didn't even throw a pass in the last three quarters, and they win the game. That's when Andy Reid sat down and said, hey, we got to make a change. They have made that change, and that's why they are back. But this is a almost swap of roles this time around.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that should be factored into all of this, whether you're betting, whether you just want to make a guess who's going to win. But I think what's more important is not about looking towards the past, but looking towards the future. This is where me and Chase kind of disagree a little bit. You know, expecting the Chiefs to maintain that identity of, you know, pound the rock with Isaiah Pacheco. You know, he's averaging like 20 plus carries. I think that the 49ers, the strength of this 49ers defense is in the front seven. It's Fred Warner. It's Dre Greenlaw. It's all those studs across the defensive line. Where they're susceptible is the secondary. And although the Chiefs don't necessarily have those pass catchers that they have had in years past, that doesn't mean that they still can't attack the weakness of the Chiefs. And I think that that should be an important aspect in whatever you're doing, betting, just guessing, talking to your friends, telling them they don't know what they're talking about. I think that has to be a major factor in this. And also on the flip side of it, in terms of what, you know, this Chiefs defense, to Chase's point, is for real. It is better than the 49ers defense. And, you know, I think that, and if you're Kyle Shanahan, you know, you have to learn at a certain point. He's been in two Super Bowls, one as an offensive coordinator, one as a head coach, and lost in similar fashion in both, in terms of getting away from the run game, his bread and butter, and kind of, you know, throwing the ball a little bit too much. As Falcons fans, as an Atlanta talk radio, we know, you know, what Kyle Shanahan did wrong in 2016. He also did the same thing in 2019. What is he going to do, you know, to kind of differentiate from the past? Can't do the same things over and over and over. What do they call that? Insanity. Whoa.
It's the Super Bowl, so that's what people remember. But if you go back to the Lions game, what did they not get away from, even though they were down 24-7? They ran the ball. You go back to the Packers game in the second half, they ran the ball. Brock Purdy has proven he can make plays down the stretch, but they never lost their identity in either of those games. So I do think he's taken some lessons, and I do think that's going to play a big role in this. I like the matchup for the 49ers because I know that the weakness is on the secondary of that team. And you think about Patrick Mahomes, but the reality is these receivers are not good. They are not good. Now, maybe they'll make a play here and there, but if you're expecting them to carry you an entire game, I think that's going to be problematic for them. I do not think they can get away from that identity. I do think they need to shorten the game because I think this 49ers offense, listen, you can say whatever you want about Brock Purdy. He's been making plays, and what they have across the offensive line and those weapons, I don't care how good the Chiefs defense, it's not the 1985 Bears. This is going to be their toughest test in the playoffs and vice versa. This will be the toughest test for the 49ers offense against their defense, but this will be by far the toughest test of the Chiefs.
No, I don't. They just beat the Ravens.
Okay, and did you watch how the Ravens approached that game? They ran the ball six times.
Right.
Now, the Ravens in the regular season.
I'm just saying if we're talking about actual, you know, on paper, what they've been, the Ravens offense has been better than the 49ers.
It hasn't been better. First of all, it hasn't been better. And second of all, the way that they ran their offense, that wasn't the same offense.
Agreed. But going into the game, we all expected the, you know, Todd Monken, this offensive guru, to kind of accentuate Lamar Jackson.
And people
Jackson.
Choke.
And I agree. But the fact of the matter is I think the Chiefs defense is better than maybe you're even giving it credit for. I'm not disrespecting the 49ers by any means, because like you said, they have studs. That it's very clear to see. George Kittle, Debo, Ayuk, Christian McCaffrey. You know, all Brock Purdy has to do is not play like he did against the Ravens in the middle of the season and turn the ball over three times, and they've got a good shot. But Patrick Mahomes is still on the other side of the ball. I bet against him in the AFC Championship for all the reasons I just listed about how the Ravens, this was the best team the Ravens had in the Lamar Jackson era. And what it comes down to is Patrick Mahomes and that defense. My eyes and everything tell me 49ers, but it's Patrick Mahomes.
I think you got to really put what happened to the Ravens on the coaching staff. I'm betting that Kyle Shanahan doesn't make those mistakes, because they have been there and he has learned from his mistakes. At least the last 2 weeks have showed me that he had. And I mean, this is not his first rodeo. This is like his fifth rodeo in a row where he's been in a game like this. And I believe in Kyle Shanahan. Now, I know a lot of Falcons fans don't want to hear that. They're probably rooting for him to choke again, and I understand why you're rooting for that. I saw the video yesterday where Julio Jones made that catch, and you realize he's at the 22-yard line with like 2.5 minutes to go, and the game is essentially over, and somehow the Falcons lose that game. Trust me, I get it, but I do know how good of a coach Kyle Shanahan is. I do believe eventually he's going to right those wrongs and win one of these Super Bowls. But listen, I'm not going to argue against Patrick Mahomes. I did it against the Ravens too. I did it against the Bills. I did it every step of the way except the Dolphins. And I am eating crow. But I don't know. I like the matchup. I just think it's going to be a fantastic game. I see no way that this game isn't decided in the final possession. And it might come down to who do you trust more, Brock Purdy?
That's exactly where I'm going. You began this by saying Brock Purdy has stepped up when the matter against the Packers, against the Lions. He has absolutely shown an ability to step up against the Packers. It was the final drive of the game, and it was glorious. That he played like crap for the entire three and a half quarters, and then that last half a quarter he played magnificently. And then the Lions, a similar, you know, he didn't play as bad most of the game, but he still came up big when it mattered most. And what I'm getting to is the Packers defense and the Lions defense does not hold a candle to the Chiefs defense. And in those moments, those 2 minute moments where you gotta have it, those gotta have it drives, I just can't fathom putting my hard earned money on Brock Purdy, Mr. Irrelevant, to somebody who could one day surpass the GOAT Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes. I can't fathom doing that. I can't.
Well, listen, the GOAT lost 2 Super Bowls to Eli Manning, buddy. So, listen, everyone has a chink in the armor, and I agree. You know, this defense, having that defense with Patrick Mahomes is almost unfair to the rest of the league because he doesn't have to make that many plays. I mean, against the Ravens, it was really just one play at the end of the game. They had those 2 drives where they went touchdown, touchdown, scored 3 points the rest of the game, and then they needed one play at the end of the game. And what does Patrick Mahomes do? Unsurprisingly, makes the play of the game to MVS out there, who has struggled all season and been criticized, and some people even wanted cut. But yeah, I agree. Let's do the predictions. Let's do it today. Let's get into it. What do you got?
Go ahead. Go ahead. If you you've got one, you know the exact score. Yeah. If you want to get rich.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be 24-23 Niners. It comes down to the last possession. Brock Purdy makes the plays. It's going to be a field goal that sneaks inside the right upright, because I do not love the 49ers. And it's only going to be from about 40 yards. Chiefs fans will have that are watching on television will have their fans blowing right. They're going to watch it curl to the right. They might cheer a little bit early, but it sneaks in. It's going to be one of those where you don't know if he made it or he missed it, but he made it. He made it, and the Niners win the Super Bowl, and Kyle Shanahan gets revenge.
Yeah, getting the monkey off Kyle Shanahan's back is how I see it going. I do think it's going to be a close game. Exact score, not as confident. I do think it's, you know, I really do think the Chiefs cover right now, it's sitting around 2 points. So that would, you know, that 24, 23 that Chase said, I think that's about right. Whether it's like something like 27, 28 or 31, 30, something like that. I do think the Chiefs cover, but like Chase, I do think Kyle Shanahan gets the monkey off of his back. 49ers win the Super Bowl.
Coming up after the break, Ozzie Albies, the 66th ranked player in the MLB. MLB Network came up with their top 10 list of second basemen, and I don't know if they thought Ozzie Albies retired or if they thought he died. I don't remember the funeral, but he was not on the list among a bunch of group of players that had no business being in front of him, some even only having 60, 70 games of experience. I mean, we're talking about a three-time All-Star, a three-time Silver Slugger, a guy that's finished top 20 in the MVP race like four different times. I mean, we're talking about one of the best second basemen in the game, undoubtedly, with a track record that only a few players can match at the position. But then they rank their top 100 players, and he comes in at number 66, ahead of four of the guys that were on the list in front of him. He was right behind Ketel Marte, who came in at number 5 on the top 10 second base list. Marte was 65. Ozzie Albies was 66. It just goes to show you these guys do not pay attention and have no idea what they are talking about. So this is why I stopped really commenting on this list. But we talked about the Albies thing, you know, a couple weeks ago when it was released. I felt like we had to just basically point out how stupid these lists are because they clearly are not paying attention.
Yeah, they clearly goofed. I think regardless of who you would ask, Ozzie Albies is firmly in the top 10. And I would wager 75% of people you ask, whether it be players, whether it be MLB executives, fans, analysts, anybody associated with the game of baseball, 75% of them would have him as a top 5 second baseman. I mean, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but Chase loves to say he's like a 4-WAR 30 plus home run guy every single season he's been healthy. And the fact is you don't get that a lot of the times when you're talking about second baseman. So it's really just the same. And even more so outside of the realm of all second basemen, just talking about who Ozzie Albies is as a Braves baseball player, he is instrumental to the Braves organization. He's the happy-go-lucky. He's the guy who keeps everybody gelled.
We're trying to stop doing that, though. We're not trying to be the nice guys anymore. No. But I agree with you. I mean, listen, sometimes greatness or consistent greatness gets overlooked because they just kind of forget that you're doing this every single year. The thing about the second base position is every single year there'll be a guy that maybe performs better than Ozzie Albies. Maybe just, you know, he has a great season, a career year. Okay, and then the next year he's half as good or half as valuable as he was the year before. What makes Ozzie Albies up there with the top three, the Jose Altuve's, and I'm not going to say he's Jose Altuve, obviously great. Mookie Betts is now a second baseman. Listen, you can put Mookie Betts ahead of Ozzie Albies. I'm not going to sit here and argue that. But what makes him consistently great and one of the best pure second basemen in the league is he does the same thing year after year after year. Outside of the COVID season when there was only 60 games and outside of the season 2 years ago when he only played 60 games because he had two major injuries, the guy is quite literally a lock for 25 plus homers, 100 RBIs, 40 doubles, an OPS of 800 plus. And it's just like, you get used to that. And you see one guy have a good year and you're like, oh, he's better going into next year. Well, the truth is, no, he's not.
Yeah, it's the LeBron James effect. Obviously, I'm not equating Ozzie Albies to the GOAT. I'm just saying that
same height.
When you have greatness year in and year out, it becomes the expectation. Whereas, like you said, you know, a guy like Luis Arraez, who is a great player, flirts with a 300 or a 400 batting average the whole season. He's all the rage this season. He's going to probably regress. He's not going to be a career 390 hitter or whatever he was. And the fact is when you kind of get, you know, that sustained success, you're easily forgettable if you're not this flashy Ronald Acuna thumping your chest. Ozzie Albies goes about his business every single day. He's a great player. He deserves praise.
Yeah, I also think it's a testament to just the Braves as a whole. I mean, he kind of gets lost. I mean, when you talk about Ozzie Albies as what he ranks on the Atlanta Braves as a player, I mean, you could be talking about the sixth best, maybe seventh best player. I mean, go through him. Ronald Acuna, Matt Olson, Austin Riley, Sean Murphy. I'm not even talking about pitchers. I'm talking about strictly position players.
That's crazy.
Michael Harris. When you're talking about WAR and these guys, I mean, those guys are all technically better. I mean, or as good, at least as good. I mean, even Marcel Ozuna went out there and hit 40 homers and had 100 RBIs. I know he's a designated hitter, but I mean, when you talk about offensive players, the guy was absolutely insane up there with the best in baseball. So I do think there's also a little bit of a Braves effect where you just kind of think, you forget Ozzie Albies is also over here hitting 30 homers with 40 doubles and 100 RBIs every season.
Yeah, that's what you get when you have seven All-Stars every single year. It's just going to become the norm where somebody forgets a Braves great. It's just the reality.
Well, coming up after the break, we have not heard from Arthur Blank since the hiring of Raheem Morris. He's got some questions to answer, and the Falcons fans deserve to hear them. Before we start this segment, we got to give a shout out to the guys at Fox 5 Atlanta. If you notice, we're in the same room. Now, truthfully, we're always in the same apartment. He's just in a different room. But now we have the studio set up in my apartment. I wish you guys could see it because it is as crammed. It's like a maze in here. But they did a great job, so shout out to them. Remember, you can always watch the show on the Fox local app, available on Roku, Apple TV. Full episodes of the show whenever you want them. Now to Arthur Blank. Bill Belichick, he's got some questions to answer. He was supposedly under the weather for the opening press conference of Raheem Morris. Hopefully, Arthur, you're out there feeling better if you're watching the show. But we do got it. We do need some answers from you, man. We do need some answers. You are the guy making the final decisions, and we deserve answers. Do you think we get them, Alex?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Blank has never shied away from the press. You know, obviously, we hope everything's okay with Blank personally and his medical. He is expected to be in Vegas at some point leading up to the Super Bowl. That's where we kind of expect the media to ask him some questions. And obviously, there's some hard-hitting ones that, you know, fans, us, Falcons fans, we deserve to know. But then there's, like, less serious ones. We're like, can you shine a light on what led you to Raheem Morris personally? Like, what really transpired behind the scenes? We've heard from Greg Beatles. We heard from Red Ukes. We've heard from Terry Fontenot. But Arthur Blank, you, the guy who makes the final decision, what was it about Raheem Morris that really sold you?
Yeah, and what about Bill Belichick? I mean, listen, we deserve answers. I mean, you're letting all these NFL insiders and reporters either make things up
you. More than anything, he could set the record straight if it's
set the record. Or lie about it. Yeah. You do a lot of that. So just it's not that big of a deal. We're used to it. But we do deserve some sort of answers from him. I do think he will give them. I don't think it was him dodging questions. But and especially, this is a big moment for the franchise. I mean, you talk about hiring a new head coach. You talk about hiring the first Black head coach in Atlanta. Now you have, I don't know if it's the first general manager coach duo that are both African-American. So there's a lot of big things that need to be addressed regardless. I mean, you made a big decision. This is a turning point in the franchise. So there needs to be congratulations handed out as much as there needs to be questions fired at him about the process. Why is Rich McKay not involved? I mean, we need to know these questions. I mean, frankly, you robbed us from what we really wanted. We really all wanted to talk to Rich McKay. You're robbing us from that. So we at least need answers from you, Mr. Blank.
Yeah, and if I was in the room, this would be the exact question I would ask. Mr. Blank, what transpired from the press conference announcing or at least facing Arthur Smith's termination to Raheem Morris's introductory press conference for Rich McKay to be your right-hand man publicly, as you two were the only one at Arthur Smith's press conference, to not even being involved in football operations just a few weeks later? What transpired behind the scenes that he was so involved in day-to-day operations and that now he's not involved at all, supposedly?
Yeah, and obviously, how much did he have a hand in this hiring process? I think Falcons fans all want to know that because, listen, Raheem Morris might have dropped the ball there. I know you PR trained him before this thing, but he mentioned that this was the fourth time Rich McKay has hired him. So now we know he was definitely heavily involved in this situation. You at least got to deflect that. I want to hear your answers, man.
Yeah. And to kind of piggyback off of what was said during the press conference, Terry Fontenot also went on a little bit of a monologue before Raheem Morris actually spoke and was kind of defending the process, defending McKay. Basically, you know, he's drafted Hall of Fame players. He's hired Hall of Fame coaches. And none of these things are a lie. He absolutely has loads of experience. He's forgotten more about the NFL than I might ever learn. But the fact of the matter is, if he's such an invaluable resource, Terry Fontenot and Falcons, why is he no longer in the building? Why is he no longer a part of football operations? There's just been, as Mark Zeno, we have Mark Zeno on all the time. Mark Zeno says it perfectly. The words do not match the actions. And it feels like the Falcons are just kind of Chase says it best. You're just responding to public opinion, and that's more damning than anything.
Yeah, I think that's the worst possible scenario, but it's also a scenario that they have to address because they're the one that have gone through this process and kind of made it a circus. I mean, you just look around the league at how all these other things, I mean, there was so much leaking, so much information. And listen, I get Bill Belichick brings that, but you got to answer questions about that because you're ultimately the only team that really took him seriously as a candidate.
Yeah, officially the only team to interview Belichick. And past that, you know, past the McKay, the Belichick, you know, even the Raheem Morris hire in general, Arthur Blank, what are your expectations for Raheem Morris this season? And in addition to that, what's the plan at quarterback? I know Arthur Blank isn't making the decisions per se, but what is your idea going forward of the quarterback position and the team?
Well, we could argue that. I mean, I think Arthur Blank is going to be the one that ultimately going to be the one that decides who the quarterback is. Now, I do think it'll be a collaborative effort. That was a big word at Raheem Morris's press conference, but I don't think there's any doubt that Arthur Blank is going to have a say, especially on the quarterback situation, something that could determine the last 3 years he has as owner of this team. Coming up after the break, a 2024 NFL redraft from last year. What would it look like for the Falcons? Wrapping up our show, ESPN Michael Rothstein, in particular, the Falcons beat reporter over there. All their team writers went through a redraft of the 2023 NFL draft. The first two rounds, obviously, Bijan Robinson was the original pick, and Rothstein had them sticking with Robinson over Jalen Carter, who went ninth. What do you think about that, Alex?
You know, I don't necessarily hate the Bijan Robinson pick, and the rookie year was by all accounts underwhelming. I think that if you're still trying to prop up that rookie year, you're just blinded by your loyalty or your love for Bijan Robinson, which we both love Bijan Robinson. There were moments, especially that Packers game, where everybody was like, oh my God, this guy is maybe the best football player I've ever seen. The fact of the matter is he wasn't utilized, I don't want to say properly, but as much as a lot of Falcons fans were led to believe, specifically as a pass catcher, that never really materialized under Arthur Smith. And Jalen Carter is still in the conversation for the Defensive Rookie of the Year. And if you want to talk about an area specifically where the Falcons necessarily haven't had a lot of juice, though we saw David Onyemata really come into his own after coming over in free agency, it's the defensive line. Jalen Carter looks like a certifiable stud. I don't know how, you know, you really go back and still say, I'm going to take a running back after watching what transpired this past year, but to each your own, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the defensive line of the Atlanta Falcons, it's been a problem area for damn near two decades. There's no way I'm taking a potential all-pro player or potential all-pro defensive tackle. There's no way I'm not taking him over Bijan Robinson. I don't care if Bijan Robinson meets his full potential, because all those things that people were knocking Jalen Carter for, the off the field issues and stuff like that, they're no longer there. They do not exist. Nobody is talking about them, and they do not matter. So I know those things have to be taken into account during the draft process, but they no longer exist. And now we know Jalen Carter has serious potential, which we already knew to be an all-pro caliber player. They could be both all pros multiple times over their career. But what are you going to take? The defensive tackle who can wreck an entire game, or the running back who needs other pieces and playing calling, as we saw this year, to really reach his full potential? The second round pick, Matthew Bergeron, was not available. Rothstein had us going with Cody Mock, so sticking with the interior of the offensive line. I don't hate this pick, but I think the Falcons did the right decision getting Matthew Bergeron. They got a day one starter. And when you look at this offensive line, especially the interior, Lindstrom, Dahlman, and Matthew Bergeron, you have to be encouraged about that aspect of the Falcons.
Yeah, I think Matthew Bergeron was probably the best pick in the draft, at least after the rookie campaign. I mean, Matthew Bergeron immediately stepped in. He grew as a player throughout the year. He performed admirably wherever you look, whatever outlet, PFF, Fox, ESPN, and they're talking about all rookie teams. Matthew Bergeron is on every single one. That just speaks to what kind of player he was. He looks like he's going to, you know, form a menacing guard duo for the next decade with Chris Lindstrom, who was already one of the best guards in the NFL. It was a home run of a pick. I don't hate Cody Mock. He's also been a very, very good player thus far. So I think obviously, you know, people took Matthew Bergeron higher in this redraft because they saw the work he did as a rookie.
Yeah, I mean, I think he actually went for 41st. We traded up at 38. But when you're talking about a redraft, you're talking about guys in the fifth round that were never even considered for, as first or second round picks, now going in the first round because they had big rookie seasons, like Devon Achane, for example. So, like, if you're picked 38th or around where you were picked in the redraft, if you were picked highly, you did pretty damn good. And I think the Falcons nailed that pick with Matthew Bergeron. That wraps up our show for this evening. Thank you guys for joining us in our new studio. We'll be back with you on Friday.